Welcome to the Continued Silence with me, Emma Jane Taylor, on UK Health Radio. The Continued Silence is focused on the very uncomfortable conversation of child sex abuse and the importance of talking openly about this subject. We do this to try and normalise a very difficult conversation. Child sex abuse is real. It affects millions of people, young and old, across the world. The work we do here is very much engaging more lateral thought processes on this terrible crime, supporting survivors, protecting children, and helping those not wanting to listen to listen. Joining me each show is my resident panel, therapist Denny Corby, activist Chris Tuck, and usually Michael Borton, but Michael can't be with us today. So each week we will be joined by guests from around the world. We will be sharing more insights on this crippling conversation, and more importantly, sharing important messages. This show is going to be joined by Dr. Laura Cobb. Laura is in Chicago, America, so great to have her with us here today. And this month's show is about child sex abuse arousals, a very difficult conversation to be having, but one nonetheless that we feel we should be bringing to the airwaves. So thank you, everybody, for joining me today. I'm going to go straight to Denny. Great to have you here with us. Okay, so, you know, we've done lots and lots of shows, lots of difficult conversations. But for me, by far, this is the most complex of the conversations we've had to date.
Yeah, nice to see you again, Emma Jane and everyone. I totally agree. We had conversations prior to this show, didn't we? And I think it is probably one of the most uncomfortable, unspoken aspects of child sexual abuse. And I think it's really important to talk about and discuss its impact upon victims. And in my experience as a therapist, how clients find it excruciatingly painful to understand and accept that that was a automatic, biological, physiological response to an external stimuli, part of the limbic system in our brain that responds to external stimuli. And I think the issue that many clients bring to my room around this when they find the courage to speak about it is that internal subconscious belief that I am bad and I am wrong, what was wrong with me, which, as we know, leads to shame and silence. So I think it's a great topic to talk about today. And I think it will be really important to, you know, I guess, give the message that we can't shy away from the fact of what our bodies do, and it's not necessarily linked to consent, enjoyment, and our emotional involvement in abuse and in child sexual abuse. So,
yeah, and I think that's really important to make that statement. You know, it's not the responsibility of the child that this happened. It is, like you say, it's an autobiological, physiological response. Okay, thank you, Denny. Great to have you with us. Chris, great to see you there. Looking all fresh faced and ready to go. A really difficult conversation for us today.
Absolutely, 100%. Many victim survivors that I've spoken to, and I include myself in that, when your body responds to a sexual act that's being done to you that you don't want to be done to you, but your body responds automatically because that's what it does, you almost believe that you're complicit in the abuse and that you wanted it. And it's really hard for some victim survivors to get their head around that it is just an automatic bodily response and they didn't want it. And for me also, I've also heard that sexual offenders feel or say, well, they responded, I showed love, they're showing love back because they responded. And we know that is not correct, that is not right, but that is the narrative that we get from the sexual offenders' side of the conversation.
And of course, they'll do anything they can, right, to turn this conversation around, to not make it about them, without understanding what Denny say, the biological side of how the body responds. And I think, you know, that's why, again, this conversation is really important, because there'll be many authorities who maybe don't fully understand the response enough. And I hope that today's show extracts lots of information that can help help the case, help survivors, victims, anyone going through any trauma with this conversation to realize that, you know, you're not bad. This isn't something that you've done and it wasn't your fault. It wasn't anything that you should be blaming yourself for. It was a response, a natural response of the body. Okay, so thank you, Chris. Thank you, Danny. Great to have you here with me today on this show. So I'm going to introduce now Laura Cobb, Dr. Laura Cobb, who is living in Chicago. She has a personal story. But first of all, I just want to hear from Laura. Let's hear a little bit from you. Would you like me to call you Dr. Laura or Laura? Laura.
You know, I'm just Laura today.
Thank you. Well, great to have you with us. Let's hear a little bit about you.
Well, my name is Dr. Laura, and that's most people that they who know me come by. I am, you know, I can downplay all the accolades and all that stuff because that's what I did to shield myself. That's what I did to achieve so that my parents might recognize me, that I mattered. Very busy doing a lot of things, trying to please other people. And that was how I was noticed. Because I felt like I didn't have a voice in my home. And even when I called out to my parents 30 years after the abuse, I'd say almost 40. I'm 50. I was 50 a week ago Sunday. So I'm 50.
Happy
I made
50th.
It.
Welcome
thank
to
you,
the club.
Thank you.
Welcome to
50
the club.
Is great. Yes, thank you so much. And it's a beautiful thing because today I have hindsight and I recognize that, sure, you can, MJ, you can go ahead and just provide all the accolades. It really doesn't matter so much as that a PhD in child development and family studies. I sat my butt in a chair for 12 years, listened to people profess about what I should know. And right now is when I'm gaining wisdom. And from this cohort that you have created is when I gained the wisdom. Yeah, I have a PhD in child development and family studies. I manage the European continent for the U.S. Army to help prevent and educate domestic violence, child abuse, and sexual assault for 4 years. I was the past president of the European branch of the American Counseling Association. And, you know, I'm here as a listener, as a learner, and to share my story.
Thank you, Laura. Well, look, on that note, let's just hear about your story, because you were sexually abused by someone in your family, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I am the quintessential redheaded stepchild with braces, glasses, and freckles. And as a third grader who implored my family, my parents, to stop the bullying that went on by my uber popular cheerleader prom queen sister, and a brother who was the life of the party, and another brother who molested me, who was the awkward, gawky one, and no one knew. And so no one heard my voice. So I was told by my parents that since they didn't witness any of the abuse, they couldn't do anything. So I was silenced at home, felt like I had nothing to cleave to. So school was respite because I got to hear the other students' stories. So I failed listening throughout the entire third grade. And my parents told me that if I failed listening again on my final report card, that I'd be in trouble. Well, I failed again because I didn't listen to the teacher. Because I didn't have the power to convey to my parents about what my brother was doing to me. And what my sister was saying to me, and what my other brother would do, would he pick out individual hair. First, he'd take the whole head, then he'd take out little individual strands of hair. And they couldn't do anything because they didn't witness it. And I remember smells, firmly touches, and fondling. And I can recall when it was winter out, we'd make igloos in Chicago. It's cold in the winter. There'd be a lot of snow. I remember one instance in my bedroom when my mother walked in and said, "What are you doing?" "Nothing." I remember other instances when we were in my brother's beds. They had two separate twin beds on different sides of the room. And my one brother and my sister was in one bed. and my brother and I were in another bed. I remember that instance. And other closets and such. And I remember very specific smells. It's very difficult for to convey. It's necessary to communicate. And nothing was ever said anything about it. So my parents divorced when I was about 4, and I know my brother, he's 7 years older than me. And I know that when he was 13, he was allowed to go to the court and requested to go live with my father and my stepmother. So I know that it stopped then. That's the only recollection that I have of when it stopped. And so I became, because he was the brunt of the bullying. I then became the brunt of the bullying. So the abuse stopped at that point. At the same time, I recall being very fascinated with encyclopedias about human sexuality. I remember orgasming when I was 5, likely. My first kiss was at 5. My first French kiss, they call it, with tongue was in 4th grade. And I think I had my first sexual encounter when I was 14 with another person outside of the home. And I believe I lost my virginity at 15. And it was almost like a release. And so throughout the years, never feeling like I measured up. I wasn't the pretty one. I wasn't the effervescent life of the party. I became the scholar. And it became an opportunity for me to be seen and to be heard because mom's kids all have to graduate from college, right? So even though throughout high school, I wasn't an exceptional scholar. I wasn't the perfect gymnast. I was voted captain on my senior year only because I'm like, let's get this going. Let's do this. I'm like the cheerleader, right? Let's get everyone together. It's the same as today. I'm a collaborator. I love getting people together and I love nurturing relationships and fostering them and cultivating them, nurturing them. So that's who I was in high school. And so when I was about 16, my mom and dad, my mom and my stepfather found my journal and found out I was having sex with my then boyfriend, who was overage, and they threatened statutory rape. So I became the expert gymnast. I wasn't great. I just was on the team and I was the captain because I was the collaborator, the cheerleader. And so I used promiscuity in order to get attention and was never part of a particular clique because I didn't want to fit in with another group because then I'd betray myself. I love Brené Brown's work about fitting in and belonging, is that I needed to belong to me. And I never did. I never belonged to me. I always fit in order to fit the mold of what someone else thought of who I should be. Should. I was always shitted on.
Okay, Laura,
So,
so
yes, ma'am.
it's a very emotional story. I found myself feeling very emotional listening to your story, and I know your story, and it still upsets me when I hear it, as it does with all survivors of child sex abuse to have go through such upset, such trauma. And this is your family, this is your brother. So I do know as your story evolved, the next sort of stages, but being promiscuous, and exploring and experimenting with, unbeknown to you, it was your brother because he was older than you. He was using you, and you were getting involved in sexual acts because of him. This has allowed you to then grow to become fairly promiscuous as a young child. As you say, you went and opened the encyclopedias. You learned all about a conversation that you shouldn't be learning about until older. You had early orgasms. A lot of influence by what had happened in those early years. I'm just going to go to Denny now. Just listening to Laura there, listening to Through no fault of her own, what had happened to her as a child, as does happen to many children across the world. But actually talking about it now, Denny, and I don't know about you, but it hits more nerves for me. And I think, you know, just listening to that, listening to the fact that a child, even at such a young age, was experimenting, was finding out more about how the body naturally respond. I wonder how many people do that, Denny.
I think actually it would be a very common theme that again isn't spoken much outside of a therapy room, I would imagine, but it's an incredibly common theme. And when you think about it, when a child has been sexually abused and their level of development in their brain and their emotional maturation, you start to equate attention to love. And attention is very intense around child sexual abuse. And we have to remember, not all child sexual abuse is brutal. It's often quite tender, affectionate, and intimate, and from a caregiver, a sibling, or someone significant, or a position of power. And so it's no wonder, is it, that the child sees the world and the attachment to the world and to other people as almost a bodily sense. It's, this is what love is, this is what attention is. And when you experience sexual arousal, and we've said it's a very biological, physiological response, and almost part of fight or flight when you really look into it. It's seen in the courts and the justice system as consent far too readily, but it's absolutely part of fight or flight with adrenaline, cortisol, and that intense stimulation. But the more intense it is, the more we perceive that that is what love is, and that is what attention. And also within that is the very, very tricky, tricky acknowledgement that it also can feel good. It can still feel good and enjoyable, and a child will seek that. They'll use that often in a way of soothing. So many clients who have been sexually abused as children actually masturbate on a very, very regular basis at a very young age, because it's what they know. It's soothing, it's enjoyable. And the shame that goes around that, again, I can only speak from the experience that I have in my room with clients who, again, and I say it, have the courage to explore this and open up. The shame and the sense of, if I enjoyed it, I must have somehow consented to it, and I must be somehow emotionally in tune with what was happening. It's a real silencer.
And, you know, I think what's really important, one of the things that came out of that conversation, Denny, or what you were just saying, is a child, by being biologically responsive, is not consenting to a physical sexual relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, as I was, bizarrely, I booked myself on a course, because personal development's incredibly important, isn't it? And I know a certain level of the brain and how we respond physiologically and psychologically, because they're two very different things. When you look at the definition of arousal, And I looked at a variety of sources, it basically says usually arousal is closely related to a person's appraisal of the significance of an event or to the physical intensity of a stimulus. Now, I would bet a lot of money that a survivor of child sexual abuse will home in on closely related to a person's appraisal of the significance of the event, because that's where the blame lies. That's where the responsibility lies. If I was aroused and if I had a sense of enjoyment, I must have not appraised this as wrong or abuse. And basically, it's the second bit for me that I hung on to, that it's the event of the physical intensity of the stimulus that activates the brain, that enables our blood to go to our genital areas. Let's talk truthfully and really about this, that engorge and provide sexual arousal. That is an automatic response to an external stimuli. And you're absolutely right, Emma Jane. The biggest message out there, if we can help anyone who is struggling with this to absolutely hear loud and clear, it would be, unusual for that not to happen. We might not be aware of it happening. We might not be psychologically aware of it happening, but our body will be responding to our external stimuli. That is not consent. That is not responsibility. And there is no blame attached to the minor.
And I think that's the message I want to reinforce. This is a non-consensual act by a child because of the autobiological, physiological response. Okay, Chris.
So I just wanted to pick up on when you are sexualized when you're young because of abuse, or if you want to call it rape or sexual assault, it all depends what words resonate with you. That confusing sex for love, and then it's almost for some victim and survivors becomes a coping strategy for them to go and be seeking it when they're adolescents and when they're adults. So again, that can bring a lot of shame and guilt on that young person because they may feel that that's what they're doing. So maybe a sex worker, for example, that I do know of, doesn't really want to be doing what she's doing, but that's how she feels the love. That's her coping strategy to deal with everything that's going on for her. So it's only in specialist therapy that you can unpick all of that and then hopefully choose the right route for you once you know what's going on for you. And also know of another survivor, EJ, that said, I don't know what I went through was abuse because I love my abuser. They made me feel good. I made them feel good. And there was no violence involved. It was just love. So was I really abused? So there are all of these questions that go on in people's heads. And it is very complex and very and can be very confusing.
Yeah, because you're moving into trauma bonding conversation there as well. And I think that's, again, something that really isn't considered enough in any courts of law when you've been groomed. And, you know, just listening to Denny there when she was saying, you know, being sexually abused, a lot of people who haven't been sexually abused, it is dark, but it's not always aggressive. It's not always threatening, because if it was, it may be not so easy for offenders to have a sexual relationship with a child. So it is a grooming that's nice. It is a procedure that's nice. It is a response that's nice. And of course, that's when you get the autobiological response. But I'm clear, and we have to be clear, this is non-consensual. This doesn't mean the child wanted sex. It is a natural response to how the body works. Laura, I'm going to just take a short break, actually, before I forget to take a short break and get in trouble. We're going to take a short break now, and we will be back after this short break. Don't go anywhere.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so Laura, I want to come back to you because this conversation about early sexualization and natural responses, the exploring that you did, I know because I've read your story, I've worked with you before, this you were over-sexualized, over-stimulated. You couldn't get enough of a physical relationship and turned to prostitution. And again, Denny, we'll come back to you in a minute, but this is something I hear quite a lot from survivors of child sex abuse. So Laura, if you can expand on that, thank you.
Yes, this is years later, in the recent 8 years, that, you know, after having exceeded anything I could imagine professionally, educationally, that even when my now ex-husband, after 17 years of being married and had a son, divorced me, and he's full custody of our child, rightly so, I didn't know what to do. And so I aligned myself with a person who, for crack and home, prostituted me. And, you know, I just consented. I didn't know any different. I didn't think of it as prostitution at the time. In hindsight, obviously, yes. I think there comes a certain sense of self-loathing, at least for my example, from my experience only, is that I needed to find out if my parents knew. Over a year, after 40, almost 40 years, I'm 50 now, I would say 35 years, I needed to find out if my parents knew. They said they didn't. Okay. So why weren't you around to protect me? Because I needed to know if they knew, why didn't they protect me? And if they didn't know, why weren't you around to protect me? And so once I found out that they didn't know, the blow was a few years later, I asked them, did you ever follow up with my brother? No, they didn't. Then there and then says that, what type of self-loathing? So if I'm worthy of nothing, then I deserve everything.
Okay, well, you know, Denny, I'm going to come to you. Pretty hard realities, but a great, nonetheless, conversation to have. You know, Laura was just... Actually, Laura, how old were you when your brother started to abuse you?
I believe I was probably about 5, and I know that it stopped around, I want to say, 9 years of age.
Okay, so Denny, for 4 years of Laura's young life, she was early sexualized. It was an education that she began to believe was part of her life. She wasn't consenting, but she was unable to not consent because she was a child, getting stimulated. And it became part of who she was into her early teens and into her life. And this conversation, I'm really pleased to be having, as awkward as and uncomfortable as it is, it's this that I think is really important for survivors of child sex abuse, for anyone listening, for authorities, to education, that when children are abused as a young child, that development, that early sexualization, that education continues to be part of their young life into their adult life. And given that our brains aren't fully developed until our late teens, early 20s, it's then very difficult for a child to remove the first part because they're trying now to undo it and they're not sure how to undo it. And I can speak for myself here. I had a delayed onset of maturity when I got into my 20s because of being underdeveloped with the reality of how I should have been treated against how I was treated.
Yeah, I mean, wow, Emma Jane, you've just spoken about a whole variety, but if I strip that back a little bit and talk about one of the theories, transaction analysis, is that by the time you're 7, your life script is in place and we subconsciously play out our life script. Well, if you think there's sexual abuse within that, it's actually not that surprising that there's this real conflicted sense of, you know, what is love, what is attachment, and it just creates so much confusion. And is it any wonder that we kind of move towards what we know? In many cases, particularly if it's the caregiver that you're sexually abused by, it may be the one area where you as a child feel There's the tension, there's love, it's a very, very conflicting emotional state to be. And so therefore we take that out into the world outside of the home, and we'll just play that out. That's how we communicate. That's how we get our attention. That's what we do to express our emotions. I think if we, sometimes clients are so confused and so ashamed that they often say, but I myself chose to be promiscuous. I chose to then go on and have numerous sexual experiences. And I think the one thing that I would say is, let's just think about that. Is that a surprise? Is that a surprise? That's your first formative years on how, A, you are seen by others, but how you experienced affection, intimate relationship, and you attribute that to love. I don't think it's any surprise that that's the pathway many, many take.
So, Denny, hi, Chris here. So you say that's not a surprise, but many people are surprised by that, even though what you've just explained sounds so commonsensical to me, you know. I also wanted to share as well that my stepdad, for example, would masturbate in front of us children, but under a blanket. But you knew what he was doing because he would hold eye contact with you whilst he was doing it. And that made me feel that sex was yucky. It was just something that I didn't want to go. It just really tainted it. And then I had my first boyfriend was at 15, and then my second boyfriend, who's my husband, when I was 15 and a half. And obviously we've been together now for over 35 years. But our relationship has gone up and down. Our sexual relationship has been up and down because of the trauma impact of what I went through with someone outside the family and someone within the family. And when someone within the family is doing this kind of stuff on a day-to-day basis and it becomes normalized, you don't know where to go with that. And trying to develop a normal sexual curiosity when you're a teenager and going into your young adult life, when it's tarred with the yuck because of what you've experienced, it can be very difficult to nurture or develop a normal sexual relationship with self and then within your own relationships.
Yeah, what I would say to that, Chris, is that when you think about it, sexual abuse from a child or the victim's point of view is as far away as you can possibly get from true emotional intimacy, safe trust, safety to.
I've just lost Debbie vulnerable. There.
So therefore, sex can often become about the act, about the orgasm, about the actual physical act, rather than the emotional intimacy and the trust and the vulnerability that it takes to truly feel connected and loved in the world. And there's the difficulty, because when you're abused as a young child, you don't feel emotionally safe. You're silenced. No one's listening to you. How do you speak those words? And so sex as an adult can either go down the route, Chris, and you were right to kind of say, you know, and point out that it's not, of course, it's a surprise to many people because the shame and blame they put on themselves. I guess what I was trying to say is when sex is always about being done to, abused, the outcome is an orgasm, arousal, then our relationship with sex is not about emotional intimacy, safety and vulnerability. And that's where the difficulties come in when you then have that with somebody who's there to give you all this safety, trust, emotional intimacy. It is the scariest place you can be. On the one hand, you meet someone, and I can speak from experience with that. You meet someone and you just think, yes, I've got everything that I really have ever wanted. Well, my goodness, the barometer of fear goes right through to the other end, because how do you experience it? You might want it, but how do you experience it? So it's a really valid point, Chris.
And, you know, staying on that conversation with adults, the silence long-term, the long-term silence about physical relationships. As children, you were groomed, manipulated, abused to have physical relationships with a senior, and you weren't able to speak up. We're talking about arousal here. So if you were aroused during the process of being abused as a child and it was a nice experience, there's that huge conflict that we've been talking about. It's not consent. And so you take that into your teens, your 20s, your 30s. And as you're really starting to develop and understand what happened to you as children, there's still this silence. There's still this, you know, this silence, this pain. You know, how can I discuss how I'm feeling? How can I explore conversations, physical relations? Because actually, when I was having orgasms as a child, they were with someone, you know, who was abusing me. So the conflict, the constant conflict of emotional, physical relationships continues. Denny, Laura, you know, how do we break that cycle? How do you break that cycle? Laura, I'm going to come to you as an adult, you know, who has been abused as a child and who has been aroused as a child and who is now struggling. What's the circuit breaker?
I think this circuit breaker is really getting brave in the wilderness, to know that, to navigate the terrain of one's life. I needed to know if my parents knew. And when I found out that they didn't know, and then they didn't have a subsequent conversation with my brother, then I realized that they're dealing with their stuff. And I have to own my stuff. And in order for me to say, they're doing this to me, why are they? It's not about me. They're dealing with their own stuff. And to find me within me is a good thing. So scary, because then I can't put off any blame onto them. My brother did the best that he could, dealing with the family that we were born into. My parents did are doing, as they're living, the best that they can do. Knowing that I am me, and right now, no one's got any control over me. When I own my stuff and said, the world's not out to conspire to get me. He's not, she's not, they are not doing anything to do anything to me. 8 billion people are not doing anything to me. When I own my stuff, there's beauty in that. There's a lot of responsibility. And now today, I'm able to respond and say that I own me, because nobody can put anything on me. And every single success is then my own.
Laura,
they're doing the best that they can. And so am I.
You're amazing that you've been so open and authentic on this conversation. So thank you very much for that. Can I just go back? You said my brother is doing the best that he can in the world that he's been given. Can you just expand on that?
We are all born into an environment in which we're coming from a closed, warm, quiet, dark environment that all we have is boom, 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 boom. And we're pushed out into the world, into a loud, bright, cold, expansive environment where we take our first breath and we're crying and we're slapped upside the backside. Things are sucked out of us and cut off. Placed on a metal slab that's very cold, and then bundled up and placed in the one thing that we know, which is the boom, 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 boom. And we conform to our environment based on our survival needs, which is food and physicality, shelter. And our bank account, which is our life account, is empty. And so all the deposits that are placed into it, our brains, literally, this is neurological, are sucked up with everything that we're taught. And that's the foundation of which we have to put forward. And what was alliterated earlier was that by the time we're 8 years of age, we have a certain way of being in the world. And we take that forward. And what we're taught is, when we're brought into this world, that family is love. And that what's taught in family, that's love. So then we take this and say, this is love. So what I knew as love is what I was taught. And it's only until the point of that I have the awareness that I don't have to be that way, which is scary, because we want to recreate what we've been taught because that's safe. And certain years of child sexual abuse, we may very well recreate that in our life because we know that to be love. And so when we have the awareness, it's scary to be different. So to jump out, and I'll finish with this, is to jump out and be different is okay today. And some, my brother, he might not be willing to do that. He might not be aware to do that. Today, I am different now because I have the awareness of I know different. He might not. And I respect him for where he's at. I love him. I forgive him. I don't like what happened. And I need to rectify. I need to reconcile with that within me. And I love him for who he is, not for what happened. He did what he did because he knew what he knew. Today, I know better. So I do better.
Thank you, Laura. Okay, we're going to take a short break then.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Come back after this. Okay, we're going to just carry on for the last 10 minutes of this show on our topic today, which is child sex abuse and arousal. You know, this is a very deep conversation and there's lots of questions and I think lots more shows for me that are coming from this. And Denny, I'm going to come to you. You know, the brother who was abusing his sister from the age of 5 through to 9 to when he moved out. You know, is that early education something that he's taking forward as an adult into as an offender? Well, we don't know, right? We don't know the reality of that. But, you know, the work that we do here is obviously to support victims, survivors, to help protect children from being abused. But also, I would like to suggest that actually we are helping to educate potential perpetrators to know what is right or wrong. And we're touching on this now at the last 10 minutes, but, you know, a really important part of this conversation.
And I think Laura touched on that really a little bit in her beautiful, I mean, gosh, what courage. Thank you, Laura, for your truth. Because I think what we do have to remember here is we are all uniquely different within an umbrella term of child sexual abuse. And we will all deal with it differently, have a different process. And some feel disclosure is where they're going to find peace. Other people can do that from within. And for me, I resonate with what you said, Laura, in terms of a very amazing therapist who helped me an awful lot. And I'm very happy to say who that is because she's part of the show at the beginning, Sally Baker, therapist, once said to me, Denny, how can you communicate differently than using sex as currency? Sex is your currency in this world. And you know what? It was the biggest impact I've had in terms of that part of my journey in recovery. You know, I'd recovered from an eating disorder. But in terms of my sexual promiscuity, my inability to hold and maintain an emotionally safe, intimate relationship, I had to own that through no fault of my own, but I was continuing to do this, was use sex as my form of currency. So on the one hand, I would be overtly sexual, but then I couldn't maintain the layers underneath it because of what happened to me. So I would resent that person and move on. And I was stuck in this cycle. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that one size doesn't fit all. And the beauty of therapy is if you feel safe and you're in a trusting environment, in collaboration, you can work out what it is that you need to move on and own. And sometimes that's what Laura's just said, which is about she can still love her brother, irrespective of the act he abused her. But that's what Laura needed to do to find her own way. And I do think, I'm going to say this, I'm going to be a bit bold, we need to be careful that we don't kind of get stuck in a one pathway for survivors of sexual abuse. It's very, very different for everyone.
Yeah, and I think that's something that, you know, is really important with the work that we're doing. With every conversation we have is exploring and expanding these conversations because they are so lateral and different. Laura, one of the things that we asked you is what you want to change. And you said, if you sit in silent fear, who will listen when you stand to speak? Empathy. It's not about walking in another person's shoes. It's not about having the same experience. It's listening to their story, believing it, and reflecting on the emotions that are consistent with theirs and waiting for them to let me know when it's okay for me to leave. So, you know, when you talk about sort of empathy and, you know, to not stand in, you know, not walk in other people's shoes, but, you know, to be non-judgmental about all these conversations, I think it's something that I think is really important for all of us, regardless of these conversations, is to take on board, is that we cannot judge someone's life. We cannot judge their story. We cannot think for one minute we've stood for a second in their shoes. And you talk about your one word being, you say one word that you resonate with, you say courage and vulnerability. And I really like the way those two come together. And for me, that kind of makes sense, because I think all of us here allow ourselves to be vulnerable in our bid to be courageous with all the work that we're doing. So for that, I thank you for. So, Denny, we are coming up to the end of the show. And again, a big show and one that, you know, I think, again, there's so much that we could talk about from here. We talked about trauma bonding. We touched on that. We talked about eating disorders and the fallout of those problems. And, you know, I certainly know myself with an eating disorder, as I know Laura has as well. So, you know, other conversations that have come from today that are really important to explore. But Denny, I'm going to hand over to you.
Yeah. It's strange to say it's been an enjoyable show because it has actually been such a raw, honest show, but that's where we need to be, isn't it? We need to start having these really raw, honest conversations. And what we do know is that silence means that our truth and our emotions and our sense of selves are stuck within. And when they're stuck within, we will find any form of self-harm to soothe us, to avoid and to make us feel better. So that's the eating disorder, the alcohol, the drugs, the gambling, the promiscuity. But the one thing that I really, really want to kind of say here today is that our education, in terms of, we often speak about young people and what we want young people, the next generation, to kind of understand. And that is that arousal is absolutely not a sign of active involvement, consent or enjoyment. And that's really, really crucial. If you think of the word arousal, that is the message we need to get out there to the police, to the Youth Justice Service, to the courts, to anyone who's working within any sexual harm or sexual abuse, that arousal is absolutely not consent. And the other thing that we haven't touched on, and I quickly want to touch on, is the myths around it. Many, many clients who, you know, if they're boys that were abused by men, go through that whole, am I gay? I was sexually aroused. Is that my sexuality? And so we have all of that complexity around. And actually, it is a myth. Most men who abuse boys are not identifiably gay men. They're having sex with their wives, their girlfriends. And so we've got that whole myth and complexity around that. And also, if we need any evidence that arousal does not mean emotional intimacy, it does not mean consent, is let's just leave this to settle into our heads. When we are changing the nappy of a baby or a toddler, or we're breastfeeding, that baby may well get an erection. Now, if that is not an automatic physiological, biological response to touch an external stimuli, that has absolutely nothing to do with the sexual act, the consent to a sexual act. If anything else, let's hold that in our heads, because we need to move forward and we need to make it's safer for people to courageously talk about that. In some cases, arousal was felt, and that then keeps their silence.
Wow. Just saying that, you've just turned that dynamic of that conversation, and I think what a great place for us to finish on today. Look, my guest today, Laura Cobb, Dr. Laura Cobb, you can find her on LinkedIn, Dr. Laura Cobb. So thank you, Laura. It's been great to have you with us today and for you to have shared so authentically your story, which, I love hearing you speak. I love the rawness on which you share a very difficult story, because I know that you always say to me, it's for the children. This is for the children. And I wholeheartedly feel the same, as I know Chris and Denny do as well. That's why we're here. That's why we all independently do all the different work that we're all doing, like you, Laura, because it's for the children. So I appreciate you. I applaud you. I wish you nothing but huge success with everything that you're doing, because I know you're doing an event soon, aren't you? Do you want to just share your event with us, Laura?
I'd love to. A cohort of mine, there's a bunch of colleagues that we're working with under a year and a half ago on Clubhouse, we ran a summit for 5 days. And we were able to rescue a 12-year-old girl who was one of the daughters of a friend who was speaking at the event on human sex trafficking and domestic violence. We were able to rescue her from an abduction within 48 hours. And we're hosting another one coming in early April. So if there are individuals who are, quote unquote, experts who work with human sex trafficked survivors, or that's their particular profession, or if there are human sex trafficking survivors who want to speak, we're working to vet individuals to speak. So please do contact me as soon as possible. We're having that on Clubhouse, Facebook, YouTube. We're going global this time. Definitely contact me early April. We need speakers and we'd love to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. I'm sure if Chris and Denny are around, they would love to get involved as well, as would I if I'm around. But certainly just putting the message out here will get the message out to, I hope, a lot of people. So Dr. Laura Cobb is on LinkedIn. Denise Corby is on LinkedIn as well. If you go and find her there, you'll find all the information you can on Denny. Chris Tuck, if you find her on Twitter, ChrisTuck_WWWHF, you'll find all the links to her websites. And of course, she's on LinkedIn as well, as am I. Also on Twitter, EJ the Mentor. It's been a great show. Thank you, Denny. Thank you, Laura. Chris, I'm just gonna come to you. You know, if you could sum up this conversation in one word, just one word, what word would you sum it up with? Sorry to throw that at you.
Please, can I say a sentence?
Go on then.
Sexual perpetrators, they know what they are doing. Children cannot consent. Perpetrators choose to offend. That's my message.
And what a strong message. It's all been brilliant. You're all wonderful. I'm so blessed to know you, have you all in my life, and for the children, for the protection of many. So thank you again. So we are trying to normalize difficult conversations. They are awkward, but actually the awkward ones make things a lot better for so many people. And the more we engage in them, the more normal they will become. For me, that is a win-win. Okay, so thank you also to Johan at UK Radio and to Christine and everyone else who is behind the scenes helping me put this show together, The Continued Silence on UK Health Radio. You're all great and I look forward to seeing you next time. For now, take care.